Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Thank you for being at this Fireside Chat. Our guest this evening is Vice President and Dean Toler. Dean Toler, we would love for you to start off by sharing a bit about your life journey. You could go back as early as you would like. I think it would be fabulous to hear a bit about how you've come to be where you are today.
Thank you. Thank you, AVP Porta. And again, you know, is this a 1 minute assignment, or is this a 5 minute assignment, or is it a 30 minute assignment? I just want to, you know, I'm good following instructions, you know, so what is it?
I think it'd be great to hear a 10 to 12 minute or so summary of a bit of your life journey and career journey, and let's go from there.
So I am not from here. I am an immigrant to the United States. I have benefited greatly from actually living in several different countries, and English is my fourth language. So I apologize for the accent, but I'll try my best. I was born in Prague in Czech Republic. This is where I went to medical school when I was 17. In Europe, there is, at least at that time, was no college. So if you did well, there's this high school that is really college, except you have no electives. You do humanities and sciences at the same time. And if you are reasonably good at this, you have essentially your pick of the university. So I went and enrolled in law school and medical school at the same time. I didn't plan on finishing the law school. I really was set on the medical school, but it was a very good avenue for me to learn about how to think in a very different way from the biological thinking on the legal side of things. And it helped me, as many different things helped me dramatically. The medical school is 6 years, not four like here. So it sort of takes the medical students a little earlier than here, as far as the knowledge and maturity goes, but also it trains them a little longer than here. So you end up more as an intern. And I started as a trauma surgeon, essentially the day after I was, after the graduation, and loved it very much, you know, and it's an adrenaline sport. You know, I always enjoyed high intensity, dynamic challenges, and I liked it. Got bored a little bit because you do a lot of things with your hands, which I like, and in team, which I like, but there's not much of that wealth of knowledge that you actually need or can use or can generate or be a part of, like many of you are. So the door opened a little bit, quite a bit actually, after 1989. That is the time that a lot of the regimes in the Central Europe, where I am from, fell. And I was a beneficiary of that open door at that time, several years after that. And I went to Cambridge in England to do my postdoc in molecular biology. And that was before the genome was sequenced. That was before we knew a lot of things that we know now about the genome and how important the different versions of genomes are. And I worked on brain tumors with Bruce Ponder and Ferguson Smith. And we would have stayed there. I had a four-year-old daughter at the time, my wife and I, and the National Health Service, which is the sort of the public option, if you will, for the health healthcare in the United Kingdom, decided in their wisdom that I have to choose either the lab or the clinic. And I was going to the Edinburgh Hospital, which is on the outskirts of Cambridge. Liked it very much, and I didn't want to choose. So I asked around. There have been quite a few smart people around me, and they said that if you want to be any good in this molecular biology that you like, you better get a PhD from the States. So that's what I did. This place was the third in the world at the time in molecular biology. The other two were on the coasts. We like the Four Seasons. We like the landscape. We like the Midwest. We didn't want to live on the coast at the time. And so we moved here. And I came here on September 1, 1992. Immediately, the second day, I went to Itasca Biological Station, which was phenomenal. It's about six or they are nodding people. So, you know, it was just like phenomenal. I was actually blown away by the nature itself, just the sheer force and magnitude of the lake, of the woods, and the distances. You know, Europe is a checkered space. You know, the distances are smaller. You know, I can tell you that. So it was fantastic. And then in the middle of this, you have this biological station where the professors from the university are teaching PCR and Western blots and this and that. And that was magnificent. And the camaraderie and you know, just everything about it, you know, I thought this was just magnificent. And that impression didn't stop. I loved every moment of my studies here. And I've never realized that we were very poor, because my total pay for the year was $12,000, which was about a third of poverty level at the time. But we didn't know that. We didn't feel poor ever. You know, we thought this was just phenomenal. We even bought a house in South Minneapolis for $30,000. Because the bank would not give me more on the $12,000, and I had to waive my medical diploma all over. Oh, I should say that I did my the boards, the American boards. I did them in Vienna and Prague, so I came with the boards, and it was great. It was great. You know, we did public schools and all that stuff. And then when I was done in about 4 years, I worked on the carcinogenesis of human papillomavirus. And again, I loved all of it. It was so good, so good. And then I was thinking about what to do with myself. And I felt and thought incorrectly that pediatric cancer is going to be the nice intersection of the clinical medicine that I like and the basic science that I like. So I started residency here, a little abbreviated, started working in the lab at the same time, did a lot of the intensive care medicine, because again, I like that. And my colleagues in the class didn't. So that was just fine. And then I ascend, you know, that was before some of the constructs that exist today existed. So at one day, the chair of pediatrics said, I'm going to buy you a pizza. And I, you know, I didn't suspect anything, you know, onerous. And we went to the top of the hospital, the cafeteria. And when I was done with the first slice, you know, he said, well, you're going to be a fellow here. I said, yes, you know, what were you going to say, right? So I started my fellowship. They knew that I'm interested in hematology, oncology. So started the fellowship in hemonc and transplant. Loved it, you know, totally perfect program for me. And essentially the same thing started, you know, at I think second last, like middle of the fellowship. A chair of the division whom I admired immensely, her name is Norma Ramsey, one of the best people and best clinicians I've ever met, called me to her office. So you just come to her office, and she said, well, you're going to start here. We wanted to start you as an instructor, but we can't because you have a PhD. So you're going to start as assistant professor. I said, yes, ma'am. And that was it. So I started, loved it because I was able to run my lab. So I started already in the fellowship working in Bruce Blazer's lab. And then developed, you know, split from, you know, what he works mostly on graft versus host disease. My was more as a stem cell biology, so I worked on that and was able to do. We were very lucky because what we thought about is important in clinical medicine and needs to be deconstructed in the lab was of interest to the National Institute of Health. So we were funded, my lab till this day, you know, is NIH funded for several decades. And we worked mostly on genetic disorders. So that was another stroke of luck that we saw an opening around what are the non-oncologic, non-cancer indications for bone marrow transplant. So my day job is bone marrow transplant, and we were the among the first who developed transplant approaches, life-saving. You know, all these people die unless you give them transplant for Fanconi anemia, dyskeratosis congenita, severe aplastic anemia, and about 12 years ago for a skin disorder that's fatal called epidermolysis bullosa. So we always had a team that was absolutely fluent from the basic science to the clinical science and motivated, dynamic, and that was it. And I was just fine doing that, actually more than that, you know, it was fantastic. And then one day, you know, somebody came to my office and said, you better put your name in the search for the Stem Cell Institute director. And I did, not because I wanted to do it, I didn't, but I am very loyal, you know, Hoden knows, Carolyn knows, I'm loyal to the institution, to people, to my family and everything. So I said, out of the, you know, the enormous benefits that I received from this institution, you know, that's the least I can do. And the leadership decided that I should do it. My predecessor, Jonathan Flagg, was the developmental biologist in the world. He actually wrote the textbooks on this, but he had no interest in anything clinical. And the leadership wanted somebody who can. So we did turn around the whole institute. It's in the Biodiscovery District, the first building on that site, and opened it to clinicians, opened it to public, opened it to legislature. And as a result of this, we were able to get the largest single grant in the history of the state from the legislature for a single condition or theme. For the $50 million for regenerative medicine, which is the grant funding that still is in progress. And then about 7 years ago, I think, same thing happened. Somebody walked in the office and said, the dean of the medical school is looking for some help. You know, it's a tough job. It's called executive vice dean. And you better put your name in there. So I did. Didn't want to do it, but I actually started enjoying this. So there were like 300 applicants or whatever. But then the finalist round, you know, in the last three, I actually started to enjoy that because it was this, it had this suddenness of you have to respond on the spot. You have to get your thoughts organized. You have to read the room, you know, things that that I enjoy in many ways. And it was unexpected. It was sort of high intensity, you know, these reviews and interviews, whatever. And in the end, you know, the dean decided to invite me to this office, which I was glad, you know, and liked it. And then about a year into this, my predecessor, Dr. Jackson, decided that he's got enough of this place and left. And I got a call from the president, the previous president, and he said he wanted me to do the dean job. And so I did. And the vice president for clinical affairs, there was a different name, you know, that sort of these titles are connected, so that that's what I've been doing for the last 5.5 years, almost six, and enjoyed it tremendously, and been delighted to be able to give back to not just to the university, but to the students, to the that come and go, and the communities and the patients, of course, something that actually does have meaning and value. And you would have to ask others if we have done well or not over the last 5 years. Was it about 12 minutes, Carolyn?
That was wonderful, Vice President Toler. I am going to look and read this room if there is anyone that has a question that came up hearing a bit of this life journey. One of the things I was thinking about, Vice President Toler, is this path and pattern that you had of being invited into leadership, not necessarily pursuing it, whether aggressively or not. Do you have any thoughts about how your journey might have been different had you laid out a checklist you felt you had to follow, perhaps?
Well, thank you, AVP Porter, because I actually think about this, and as many other things that I'm happy to share, I have done them certain way, but I'm not necessarily recommending that they are good for others. So I have no credit to take for the fact that I actually don't get anxious. I just don't, you know, and that's something that perhaps self-selected me to ICU and operating room and, you know, other things. But in the leadership, only from retrospect, you know, it's sort of predetermined. I'm not saying it's better or worse. I'm just saying that it predetermines a certain different approach to what do you do with your life. So for me, I was actually never really concerned that I would not be able to do something meaningful. And granted, you know, I would be fine at any of these stations that I described if I lived my life professionally in these stations, and I think that I would be able to contribute well. So what happened, though, is that the external circumstances, like the fall of communism, the ability to go to Cambridge, the ability to get into the grad school here, the choice of the field of pediatric oncology, the fact that we were able to open you know, some new pathways for treatment and transplant, that all has been, if there is one denominator, it is that I actually didn't have a plan, that I didn't have, you know, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do that. And I can tell you a lot of my colleagues actually do, you know, they say, I'm going to be this for this much, then division director, then chair of the department, then dean of the school, then provost, and then the president or something, right? I never done that. I actually don't even know how this would help me, because I am very humble in front of the entropy and the variance. I almost enjoy, you know, looking at what life is as a flow of possibilities rather than a goal that you work backwards from. So in this way, the only credit that I can take for anything is that whatever I was doing, I tried to do it to the best possible way I could, and elevate the others around, you know, have you know, enable the little systems and the larger system to be permissive environment for others to succeed. Because again, there's no arrogance, believe me, there's no ego in this, but I was actually never, and my wife points out this to me frequently, I was never afraid that I would fail somehow. You know, I can die of accident tonight. I hope I won't. But you know what I mean? You know, I'm painfully aware of the fragility of human existence, but I was not really driven by fear or anxiety or ego or narcissism to be visible or anything. So what happened is that by virtue of doing whatever I was doing reasonably well, doors open. That's what it is. And only thing that I did, I just walked through that door. And like Alice in Wonderland, you know, what happens is you open the first room and there are three more doors. Or that you open another one and there are three more. And that's imperfect, but you know, the best answer I can get, maybe be bored.
It's wonderful. As you were talking about doors, I was thinking, well, there's also the Chronicles of Narnia, where you end up in an entirely new land, which happened to happen here as well.
That's true. And C.S. Lewis is one of my favorite authors.
Also over in Cambridge, I believe, or was he Oxford? Yeah. Okay.
Well, you know, I'm like, there's the other thing. I'm not tribal. So I you know, yes, I did the punting races for Cambridge, you know, against, but I always felt this is like the same thing.
Right. Oxbridge. Right. Exactly. It was. And again, I'll open it up if there's anyone that has a reflection, a comment, or a question at this point. Kevin's going to go ahead and make a comment or ask a question.
Please.
Yeah, thank you for sharing about your path. I really value your reflections about all of the different possibilities and view of seeing many possible open doors at each pathway. And it made me wonder, like, as someone who is in a big leadership position and has been several times, it sounds like, I'm curious about what you value in a leader and what you think makes a strong leader.
This is a fantastic question, Kevin. I'm working on that almost every day. I really am. I'm trying to understand it better. I'm trying to be better at it as I go. And what I would think is, okay, let me start, you know, from sort of a free association. First of all, leadership emerges from context. You know, it's really important that that it is rooted in something that is in front of us, that is right here, right now, and actionable. The second thing is that the systems that we lead are path dependent. It actually does matter what the history of the issue has been, and it does matter what, you know, it limits your decisions, because the history constrains the future path. And then I pay a lot of attention to the orientation of the system. What I mean by that is that there's a likelihood of certain future states over others that can be explained by the history of the system, its capacity of, you know, how you do that, and then also the context of the moment. So these are the three things that I think defines leadership, at least for me, and helps me. In practical terms, what it means is, which is probably the most important part, but I should say at the beginning, that leadership is a collective pursuit. You know, it is never the efficient one. It's never a single individual. This has to permeate, and AVP Porta and Hoden, you know, know how I think about this, because they have seen this kind of a leadership at different parts of where I serve, but it's incredibly it's sort of fundamental that this is a collective pursuit and has to be considered as a team. That doesn't mean that we decide by committee. It does not mean that we need to have a consensus on everything. That would absolutely diminish the high quality, high velocity decision making that I associate with any good leadership. But it does defer, like tonight, it defers to a group as a source of intellect, as a source of emotional charge. It defers to others for the sources of leadership without abdicating the responsibility for the decisions. Does it start to answer your question, Kevin?
Yeah.
Should I go? Go.
I think that all of the components, the context, the history, and thinking about the future and the team around you, all of those things I associate with a lot of situational awareness, which feels very valuable. but happy to hear more if you have more reflections or if anyone else has.
You know, without being boring, you know, I'm going to share with you, I have sort of like many of us, you know, I use these sort of tactical heuristics because it's helpful to have sort of the pre-form, pre-thought unit that one can apply to a challenge. And one of them is that the leadership is about, as I said, high quality, high velocity sometimes, decision making. We owe it to people who are in our little platoons. But how to get that? You know, I think it's really important to position it again in that context. And from that context comes prudence. Prudence, in my view and understanding of the concept, is ability to make high quality decisions in the context of the current situation with the view to the consequences that have that will follow and the view to the history of the issue at the same time. To get there, I think that what I learned from my patients, and I'm not exaggerating if I'm gonna say that I learned most about how to live my life from my patients. They have cancer. They are teenagers, or it's a young family. Typically, that's the setup, and being able to be a part of their what they think is a tragic journey, but not necessarily having the honor and privilege to walk with them through this has taught me a lot of things that I use in this office day in and day out. The first one is resonance. The first one is you meet them where they are. You don't tell them this is how it is because, and it can be whatever because you don't. It's disrespectful, doesn't function. You meet them where they are and you find a way, and it usually doesn't happen right away, but you try to find a way, that's actually a better way, that feels correct. That somehow reflects the coherence of their lives with what you are gonna present, and that sometimes again takes time because that what comes out of that is what I call emergent property. You know, this is from complex systems. You know, from the logic. You know that some things are predictable and something are emergent property. If you have a pile of sand, adding a little sand on top of that and building the hill, that's given. When it falls down like a sand pile, that's an emergent property. You cannot predict it. You know it's going to happen, but you don't know when. The second is that I try to, with limited success, that's true, but I never give up, build in sort of adaptive capacity to this. Again, I learned it from my patients. I know, you know, she's got a leukemia. I know what's in her path. I hear roughly hear from her what her fears and anxieties are. You know, I'm going to lose my hair. I'm going to miss 2 years of my high school. I'm never going to have children. I can sort of, you know, map a little bit, you know, for myself where she may go. And I'm trying to build the adaptive capacity to what we are talking about. And the same in this office. You know, there are a lot of decisions that I make that are difficult for people to accept. And I'm looking mostly, I spend a lot of time to building this resonance and this adaptive capacity in my chairs, in my directors of in my faculty, my students, and so forth, so that when we get to the point that a decision has to be made, because you cannot, as I said, you cannot abdicate the decision making. Not making a decision is a decision. And then the best you can do is that people will respect it. You cannot, by virtue of complexity, you cannot really, you know, get to, you know, full consensus. Doesn't exist. The third one would be psychological safety. I think it's really important not to put people in any station, in any age, in any circumstance, into the position that they are fearful, that they are anxious about, you know, what you brought, you know, to them or upon them even. And, you know, having this this ability to provide them with assurance, essentially, that they're going to be safe psychologically. I presume that physically they will be safe, but psychologically not so much, you know, as we all know, you know, from the interactions, you know, that are happening. And the last one for me is always to have, as Houghton well knows, I always try to learn from all of these meetings, including this one, how to process information better, how to get better understanding that I can use next time, you know, when I'll speak to a similar group like yours or somebody totally different. Okay, I'll stop here.
Thank you, Vice President Toler. Yeah. Houghton, I know I've given you a few questions. Let's get ready with your first one. Before that, though, I would really like reflection on this phenotype you have of not being afraid you will fail. Where did that come from? How did that originate in you, Vice President Toler?
Well, AVP Porter, as I tried to say at the beginning, it's innate. I take no credit for it. Hmm. It's just, you know, somebody's tall, somebody's short. You know, the only, again, you know, thing that I did, I didn't spoil it, you know, for myself. what's called conditional good. You know, you can do with this, you know, awful things, I guess, you know, if you are not afraid and not anxious. But you can also do good things, you know, with this. I can, again, you know, because that my examples, you know, must come, you know, from the sort of clinical environment. But I've seen people who are far brighter than I am, better educated, better prepared, better educated, to freeze in a code. They know all of this, you know, but there's this blue baby that's going to die in 60 seconds or 2 minutes or whatever. And they are totally paralyzed. I am not, you know. I still remember, you know, if I may, little thing, you know, at the beginning of my residency, you know, I was in Hennepin County Medical Center is the safety net hospital, as you may know, and I, you know, it's the population is very different than at Mayo Clinic, and I leave it at that. The pediatric resident at that time, because of the staffing issue, was in charge of the whole ICU. And I had a baby that was brought by an ambulance. There was an accident, car accident. I didn't treat the whole car, but I got the baby. You know, she was about this big, you know, so she was like, I don't know, 4 months, 6 months. And I saw she's dying. There was no other way, you know, everything was, and there was nobody. I didn't have an X-ray. I could get an X-ray, but I knew it would. So one thing that I did benefit from, and this is again unearned benefit, physical diagnosis. You know, there were very few things that I found lacking in the United States. This was one of them. You know, we were trained. You know, you listen to your patient. You touch the skin. You look. You know, you smell. You pay attention, and I was trained that way. So I was able to figure out pretty quickly that the reason she's not doing well is that she has fluid around her heart. It's called pericardial effusion. And you know, so that was good that I knew at least, you know, part of the story. But the second one was that you know, I had to take that needle, you know, and, you know, put it over here, aim for the xiphoid, you know, and there was just, you know, a couple of minutes, you know, that you have. And I still remember, not in the moment, but afterwards, I was totally calm. I put the needle in, waited for the fluid to run out, and she was fine. But again, you know, I cannot take credit for this other than, you know, I'm profoundly grateful for whatever that is that gave me that ability not to be afraid of the of things of that circumstance. Sorry for the long answer, AVP Porter.
It's a lovely example. Houghton.
Yeah, okay. So this next question, I know, Dr. Toler, you've always talked about kind of the gratitude within your very well-established career. But what is one skill you wish you had learned sooner or invested in developing earlier, whether it's in your professional life or personal life?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say patience. I'm not very patient. I'm sorry. Hold the nose. I'm trying my best, believe me, because I know that, so I'm going to be totally blunt. Very few people keep pace with me. You know, I have just different pace, you know, in my mind. And I am sure that I'm guilty of, especially at the beginning, you know, that you are asking the skill. Yes, patience would be a skill that would have helped me, you know, I think at the initial, because I was always, you know, hungry for, you know, what's next, what's coming next, so how do I get this done and that done, and that's why till this day, you know, which again I'm going to apply my newly acquired virtue of patience to that, is that people say, so what do you what can you ditch, you know, every time that I take on one of these things, they are like, oh, so what are you going to stop doing? What, you know, what the best version of this is, what percentage of your time you're going to devote to this or to that? Totally incomprehensible question to me. I don't know. You know, it comes very naturally to me to do this at the same time. And I am, as Holden, I hope, would agree, I delegate. I'm delighted to delegate to people, because then I see them grow in ways that they would probably never did. And I'm trying my best to externalize patients. Internally, not very much.
Thank you.
Reflective thought to add off of that, Dean Toler. I think the bit that you shared about, for both as being a leader and in patient care, having this sort of emotional humility, in emotional competence, I think is a very valuable reflection. I wanted to add to the question of leadership and asking, how do you balance the need for innovation and thinking forward with the need of stability and consistency when it comes to, you can talk about this in the context of patient care, or even as a leader in the medical education field, and trying to navigate maybe some of these competing priorities of growing the healthcare industry, but also trying to maintain that stability and consistency that is so beneficial for many people.
You're good. Thank you, Salika. This is a very good question. So I may be a little unorthodox in this, and that actually is an extension of that emotional humility. And I think a part I'm hungry for knowledge, so I have acquired some, and Holden can tell you how many books I buy and read, and actually, you know, lots. So the emotional humility with the fact that I do feel comfortable in math and logic and, you know, number of languages and arts and history. I'm not bragging. I'm just trying to position my answer, you know, and explain my skepticism to these flashes of brilliance, because I don't think they exist. And if they do, they are actually not as impressive to me as they may be to others in arts. And they are not as useful as one would want in the clinical care or in the basic science. The best representation of this is, so as you probably can tell by now, I have many teachers. My flaw, or my deficiency, is in part that almost all of them are dead. They are dead for 2,000 years or 200 years or 20 years. I've never met them, you know, but I feel with them when I read their books, and I can sort of attune to the wavelength. So one of them is, never met him, Stuart Kaufman. I have his books up there on the top shelf, from Santa Fe Institute who brought me to the concept of adjacent possible. So if you know where the Biodiscovery District is, the last building is the Cancer Research Center, and there is a sculpture in front of it that depicts that concept. But it basically, it comes from physics, you know. So I had to, I'll get back to the answer. I'm not forgetting your question about the innovation. So basically what it means is that certain physical states can only happen on the transition from one state to another. Simple. You know, it's like Markov's model. You know, there's a certain path dependence from, you know, some, it's obvious. I'm not going to explain more. But what it means in innovation, in my opinion, is that you cannot skip over a step. And it's so obvious, you know, that I'm surprised that that it's not sort of more internalized. But I personally think that the innovation is a stepwise process. It's not a flash of brilliance. It is typically a network phenomenon where you have these multiple nodes, multiple links, and they accomplish what Stuart Kaufman called catalytic snap. He tried to explain life. How could complex molecule begin? And he explained it that if you have three molecules or three little atoms, perhaps, at that moment, they would not make a complex molecule. But if you go further and you have 30, his number was 23, it's almost inevitable that they will have this catalytic snap and create a complex molecule like protein or RNA or something like that. So what I take from this is that you can actually have that kind of a catalytic snap, and you can, you know, I can describe this and put it on top of the how the cardiac pacemaker was made here in this building and first used. You know, that's exactly what it is, or how the sticky note was described in 3M. You know, it doesn't have to be a medical thing. And what I took from this, Sanihai, is that the best I can do is to build a system around talented people and let them do the innovation. So in other words, I'm not telling them, go discover, I don't know, a new artificial brain over here. That's ridiculous. You know, it's a scientific fiction. You know, people may enjoy, you know, thinking about this, but that's not how it works. You know, what really works, in my opinion, is to have, you know, you have people with dementia, you have Alzheimer's disease, you realize how much burden that is. You have Ramon y Cajal, if you have not seen his drawings of neurons from the silver stains from the beginning of the 20th century, you should. It was the Weissman actually had a couple of years ago a beautiful exhibit, you know, that is just unbelievable. His books are over there. So you have that, you know, the substrate. Then you have this this ability to look at the unit of consciousness as a circuit rather than a cell, like it would be in the liver or in skin or something. And then it snaps. And what snaps out of that can be deep brain stimulation that we do for people with Parkinson's or obsessive compulsive disorder. That's how I think about innovation. So I'm much more skeptical about, you know, I'm gonna sit here and just think, you know, that innovation doesn't happen. You have to be there doing this. And as you do this, almost as an afterthought, the innovation happens. And most of the innovation that my group came with, if not all of it, came from my students, not from me, for sure. I mean, my name is on the papers, you know, because I, you know, I'm sort of trained to recognize the value of it, perhaps, because most of these, catalytic snaps are useless. That's also very important. And there's a very important component of failure that is, unless you build it into your discovery mechanisms, you will never discover anything, right? You know, so that adjacent possible, that ability to build permissive system around innovation, and I think profound humility to the very rare instance when that true innovation actually occurs, and how you domesticate it, how you harness it and develop it. What do you think about the answer?
I think that is an incredible reflection.
B-minus?
No, it's an incredible reflection. I appreciate your hitting on the points that it's about both taking it one step at a time, you know, taking it one page at a book at a time, and then also being able to foster leadership in the community to help then initiate that innovation. So being
realistic
and being humble at the fact that you're going to fail, it's not going to go as planned, but if you want to move forward, you have to push others to move forward with you. So that is a very beautiful reflection.
You thing. Said it better than I did, but yes, we agree.
I just summarized it. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I think as a medical student, one of the questions that we really ask is kind of how do you balance those two things? It tends to be challenging with all of the changing environments and the changing pressure. And I think it's a bit about grounding yourself, but then also surrounding yourself with people who have similar visions. So I appreciate that reflection, Dean Toler. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. But if I may, you almost gave me a permission to make another comment, which is it's supposed to be difficult.
Yeah.
Okay. This is really important. You know, it's not supposed to be easy. And I almost think of the contradictory situations and the cross pressures that are reflected by a lot of people, you know, in the society, and the net effect of which is, you know, a huge burden on you know, mental health crisis and, you know, challenges, you know, at work and flexible work and virtual and this and that. What I think is, it may be in many people, not in all, but in many people, it can be sort of taken as a almost a therapeutic identity narrative creation. Because I can tell you that when I was, you know, 15 or 16 or 17, you know, I went in a lot of different directions, and not of all of them, you know, almost none of them actually were that satisfying. And so it was a time of struggle. The, you know, the Bildung, you know, that Germans, you know, would describe, you know, you sort of grow into your identity and you don't try to avoid it, you know, because it's uncomfortable. So I think that there is something in that as well that makes me answer your question about balance. I actually don't think that for me, it's not productive to say, how am I going to balance this? No, just go do it. You know, you'll figure it out on the way.
I appreciate that. And I hope that as you're listening, you're seeing through his lived experience and his perspectives, someone who sets the gauntlet and welcomes and challenges you to be different and to do different. Hoden, let's go to the second question. It's a nice way to wrap this up.
Yeah, it's a fun question. And knowing Dr. Toler, I know he'll really enjoy this question. But so Dr. Toler, please share your favorite books or podcasts or music you are enjoying these days, or if you have like an all-time favorite. Yeah, please share.
Oh, that is a wonderful question. So let me start with the shock that the newcomers to the office, I don't know if Hoden can share this, that happens like on the cusp of the afternoon to evening on Friday, when I'm sort of in this reflective mode, and I listen to opera. I love opera. I always did. I grew up with classical music and jazz, you know, for that matter, and other things, you know, but I, there's something, you know, in opera that just gets me. And it is as almost all music, you know, from these periods, you know, at least to me, you know, it's sort of unexplainable. And it shouldn't be explained. It's like math, you know. I don't know why math exists. You know, there's applied math, but I mean the music is a little bit like that. And then I have Maria Callas is for me the go-to opera singer. I wish I could, but I don't really care that much to explain this. I know that there is nobody for me. That ever has taken the human emotion to the dangerous an appealing place that that we can also exist in. I read a lot of books, you know, and they change. So I cannot really say that there is one or two. For me, it's a journey. For me, it is a, you know, one book cross-pollinates to another and to another and to another. And I do have a vice that if I like something that's... So for me, integrity is paramount. I didn't say that. But integrity, there's one virtue that is cardinal for me. In everything that I do and everything that I write. Integrity is one. So I start with what doesn't work. You know, if I read a false word or statement, you know, in a book, I drop this. You know, I'm done. You know, I cannot go further. In the opposite, if I grow into the mind of the author, and if she wrote something like George Eliot, you know, like, you know, she didn't really, she wrote computer. Ada Lovelace, you know, is another, you know, hero of mine. She was the first computer scientist. She was the first one who wrote algorithm. Or if this is, you know, somebody like, Immanuel Kant is one of my favorite, you know, on the other side of things, on the T.S. Eliot, you know, on the poetry side. I like the sort of the early Renaissance, you know, with Boccaccio and Petrarch and Dante. I don't know if he come Dante into Renaissance or not, but, you know, he was around. I like Goethe, you know, tremendously. So there's a lot of intersections, you know, that I create, you know, in this. Podcasts, I don't do podcasts, so I cannot even, you know, tell you what it is. I do listen to books, but they are pretty much the same books, you know, when that I would read. And I actually do sometimes, like over there, you know, I have, if you don't know Sarah Bakewell, you may want to try. She's one of these authors that externalizes my vice, which is when I like something, I read everything that person wrote. So I actually wait for every book, you know, she writes, because she wrote a book about one of my all-time favorites, which is Montaigne, who lived in the 16th century, Frenchman, essays and so forth. And then she wrote a book about peach cocktails in Paris, about existentialism. So Albert Camus, you know, is, again, one of my go-to people for the myth of Sisyphus and for... L'étranger too, you know, the stranger, it's not the right translation, but for his stance in life as well as that. And then the book that I have over there on the stand is on humanism, how it morphed through ages. And so I enjoyed that. I like Carlo Rovelli. Again, you know, I would at least dip, you know, into this. He's a physicist, you know, that's trying to put together two very different and incomprehensibly unexplainable together things about relativity, Einstein's relativity, and gravity. What he works on is a quantum gravity. It sounds like, you know, not interesting, but look at his books, you know, about time, about the one that I just finished is on Anaximander, who was a Greek or Turk, you know, it depends, you know, he was in Miletus, you know, he was where essentially the view, the scientific view of mankind started. So I have answered imperfectly your question, Houghton, but...
No, thank you, Vice President Fuller. It was wonderful. We will compile the list, add it to our growing list. We appreciate the time this evening. I think we can all say we've been challenged, we've been encouraged, we've been inspired, we've laughed and we've reflected, and we thank you for the gift of your time. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the gift of your time and your questions and listening to me. All right. Good night.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore health sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.